Welcome to Faces of Success Radio and TV. We have Henry Sotelo here today for an exclusive interview. Welcome to Faces of Success. How are you doing today?
I am doing great, Pearl. Thank you for having me. This is such a great opportunity and an honor to have you interviewing me, talking to me today on our Sunday.
Well, I know you have a lot going on with your campaign right now. How's it going for you right now?
It feels great. It's been a long process. Campaigning is no joke, I got to tell you. We started really in earnest campaigning for this position in January. We were, you know, jockeying, figuring out who's going to be filing where and what persons to file against, not necessarily, I don't want to say against, but which position to file for in Reno Municipal Court. So me and my team decided on Department 4 of Reno Municipal Court. And before I forget, SotelloForJudge.com is my campaign website. There's a lot of information there. I've built quite a lot of information and experience, and it's all on that campaign website. So if folks want to learn about me and my campaign.
Well, congratulations on your campaign, and I am so excited for you, and you know, you got my vote, so, wow. You know, we're going to be campaigning for
you. That's the one that's going to have me win. I'm going to go over the top on your vote, Pearl. I would love that.
Well, let's talk about Henry Sotelo, okay?
So, thank you.
I have had the opportunity to work, you know, with a lot of different people, you know, throughout the community, but this is like a great honor to have you here today.
Wow,
and so
you.
I'd like to know, you know, from your early years, how did law enforcement, you know, apply to your daily activities?
Okay, so how far back you want me to go, Pearl? Because I'm an old guy now. There's a lot of water under the bridge.
You'd like to start.
Okay, so I'll just give you a little bit of my family history. My parents were first generation Mexican Americans. They were born in the border town of Del Rio, Texas. Big Latin Mexican community there, as you may well appreciate, because border of Mexico. And they grew up poor. They grew up real poor. And my grandfather worked real hard. Grandmother and grandfather worked real hard. And they decided to find some opportunity elsewhere. It wasn't happening there. So they decided, my grandfather, with a good friend of his, Lico, moved to the East Bay, moved to the Bay Area, and became longshoreman. That's where the opportunity was. That's where the money was. It was in Oakland. They shared a room. Then eventually they saved money, as a lot of so-called immigrants come into our country, saved money, and then brought their families. And ever since then, we've all been settled in the East Bay. I grew up there till I was 18, but my father and mother worked real hard also and brought me and my five other siblings up as good as they could and provided us with a good, almost middle-class background in raising us. I went to Catholic school, you know, which I call the middle class or the blue collar private schools, right? And so I learned a lot. I had a great education. My parents put a lot of love and effort into me. And during that time, it's funny, I'm the firstborn of six, and there's a lot of pressure on that firstborn to do stuff and achieve. And from the day I could remember, my parents were, you're going to do something else. You're going to go farther. You're going to prove us proud. And so you take that into consideration when you're going through life and the pressure's there. And they always said, you're going to be a doctor or a lawyer. That was it. Those were my choices in life, and I didn't know any better, so I couldn't be a doctor. My math skills were terrible. Science skills were bad. But my English, you know, speaking, writing, understanding, comprehension was very high. So that led me into believing that I should go into law and that idea. I eventually moved from my mom and dad's house to Reno at 18. And I came here with a friend of mine who wanted to go look at the college. I came with him just for fun because it's a road trip. You know, two 18-year-olds coming to Reno. Are you kidding me? Sounded great. So when I saw the campus, that was it for me. I was in a transition period too. I wasn't sure I was going to attend a college in California, what I was going to do. And I saw the campus there. I saw the area of Reno and how beautiful it was. That was 1980. It's grown a lot since then, but it was still pushing growth then. And that's when I decided to stay here and make roots here. And I went to college at UNR, graduated, and went to law school after that at McGeorge, Sacramento, on a Witchy scholarship, which is a scholarship outside the state of Nevada because we didn't have a law school then. And that's when I came back and decided to start my career here in law in northern Nevada. And my first job was with the judge. Charles McGee was a great opportunity as a clerk, law clerk for a judge, district court judge. You see a lot of lawyers. You meet a lot of lawyers. You get to see the inside of how the court process works. And it was a perfect entree into the law and led me into being a prosecutor for a little while. So when you're talking about law enforcement, there's a difference. So law enforcement has to do with police, law enforcement, you know, sworn officers, and also prosecution work close with them. So I learned a lot working in the felony prosecutor for Washoe County District Attorney's Office.
Okay. So have you had the opportunity to work on both civil and criminal matters?
I have. Over my career, 30 years, I have worked civil matters. My favorite area has always been criminal law, but I also, when I went into private practice eventually, after working a few years at the district attorney's office, I learned a lot about civil law. I learned a lot about civil law would be completely different. Lawsuits, people's disputes that are not criminal in nature, contracts, all of that stuff I've learned through practicing some civil law. But basically, my focus, majority of my time has been in this criminal law area, criminal justice, criminal law area. And I've just loved the dynamic between the government, you know, dealing with individuals that are involved in crimes. And I've been very fortunate to be able to experience that from both ends of the aisle, meaning I'm now considered to be a legal defender, which is the public defender for the city of Reno. So I get a lot of clients, and I've experienced a lot of that representation, even at the district court level, felony level, too. So that's been a great opportunity, too.
So what do you find most challenging about your job?
When you're a lawyer, and I just was having a conversation with a friend of mine, your job is to take on other people's problems. When they come to you, that's not because they're happy or they're in a great time place in their life. So you take on their problems, and their problems become your problems professionally. But that's the hardest part over the years that I've learned is that line to keep it from crossing, from being taken too much in. The law itself, researching the law, arguing the law, advocating for clients, you know, understanding that comes, we've all learned how to do this. All of us in law have learned to do this. The hardest part is separating your personal and private, your professional and private life, because they flow, definitely the professional will flow into your private life quite a bit because of the fact that you're thinking about these cases, think about these folks' problems that you have. And that could be as a civil lawyer and a criminal lawyer, same thing, kind of different areas you're dealing with, but the same concept. So the most challenging part is separating the two and having your own life and be able to back off a little bit so you have a little bit of calm and not get stressed, anxiety. I don't know if you know, but I don't know the stats, but the stats about lawyers with alcohol, drug abuse, you know, have mental health issues come up later on in life. It's really up there. So that's been my real challenge in trying to separate. The law's fun. Going in there, going to court, you know, stepping up, being an advocate. I love being an advocate. I love arguing about certain nuances or facts or trying to help someone get out of a situation they've been in. That's a great time. But then all that, you know, the repercussions from all that intensity, it does flow over. So yeah. Long lawyer answer, the stress.
Yeah, it seems like it could be very, very stressful, you know. How did you decide to become a judge?
So that is a good question. And I've been campaigning for a judicial position, I've been asked quite a bit. So I wasn't really, for a long time, I know a lot of lawyers think they'd like to be a judge, and that's kind of like a goal. I never quite thought about it like that. I love being an advocate. When I was a prosecutor, I loved being in that courtroom as a prosecutor and going after folks that are real bad, you know. I'd always try to cut breaks for folks that needed a break, and I could understand. I'd try to read between the lines. So I wasn't one of those with just one blinders on and not caring. I did. And that's one of my strengths. I can see between the lines. Like when I see things, I try to work with folks and I try not to try to, you know, go after them too much or punish them too much. But those that deserve it, I was very, always excited, always ready to go. And I loved being an advocate in that end. And then when I became a defense attorney, looking at it from the other end, which is a whole different ball of wax, unless you step in the shoes and deal it from that perspective, you don't know. You think you know as a prosecutor how it would be if you're a defense attorney, but until you're doing it, you don't know. So anyway, when I stepped into those shoes as defense counsel years later, I loved being an advocate. I loved being an advocate. So I found out this is what I really like to do. I'm just going to, you know, either side, you know, whatever comes up. But at that time, it was defense work. So, but seeing what the judge had to do, it just didn't look like an exciting job to me. I mean, yes, there's respect. Yes, there's a certain amount of power within confines of, you know, the duties and the law and what you're allowed to do. But it didn't intrigue me that much. It wasn't until I started working as a city prosecutor after being defense counsel for a while. That's why I was telling you I went back and forth a little bit. Opportunity arose for me to be a city attorney dealing with lower level crimes, but high volume crimes in the city of Reno courts. I started to see how people who were just getting into the law, breaking laws, could become more and more criminalized by the punishments that we would mete out. And I tell everybody this. We had three tools at the time as a prosecutor: jail, community service, or a fine. That was it. We had nothing else to deal with. We had no other way to try to mold people into stop doing what they were doing. And there was a lot of recidivism. Still is a lot of recidivism. People returning for offenses. Mm-hmm. And I thought to myself, there has to be a better way. There has to be a better way. During that time, the late 80s, what was being developed was the concept of specialty courts, mm-hmm. therapeutic courts. Mm-hmm. So what that means, basically, it's a fancy word. It basically means the court is not there just to punish certain offenders. People get screened. There's people that are, you know, that are dangerous. They're not going to be eligible for these specialty courts. But the courts are going to slow down the process and work with these people who are not necessarily criminals, but committing criminal offenses. We brought therapists into the court. We brought social workers into the court. And we allowed them to educate the lawyers and the judges about what people are going through. Because when you're a prosecutor, you're not really worried about what they're going through in their personal life. All I know is that they committed a crime, and I'm going to prosecute them for that crime. Mm-hmm. As a defense attorney, my job, you know, black and white, is I'm going to try to minimize any, you know, too much punishment on them, or I'm going to try to work a negotiation where they're not going to be overly punished, and also look for problems with process, police, you know, what if the police didn't do everything properly. Look for things like that. And so you're thinking in details like that. You're not thinking about the big picture of the humanity and how the court can affect humanity and a person involved in that process and what they're bringing to the table and as far as their problems or core issues. Once we started getting our own education from the therapists, from social workers, and also doing outside education from different nonprofits for these ideas of specialty courts, you start seeing everybody as an individual and you start looking at them as, okay, what are they dealing with? What can we do to prevent them from ever coming back? Rehabilitating, the true concept of rehabilitation. And part of that is that a lot of courts decided to start having different tracks for these folks screened that are willing to step up and say, I want to solve. I don't want to commit crimes anymore. I don't want to be involved in criminal process. Help me get out of this, I would say, this path I'm stuck on for whatever reason because I can't get myself out of it. Okay, we're here to help you. 12 to 18-month programs. The model is 12 to 18-month program. We are constantly supervising them. They're coming in weekly to speak to the judge, and there's a team that are also working with them, including therapists, including social workers, including defense attorney, including prosecutor and the judge, right there. We're all sitting there as a team helping this person. It's sort of like what the medical community does. When someone has a serious, let's say, cancer, right? Mm-hmm. And they have to cure that cancer. They have to find a way to get rid of that cancer. They staff it. And that's what we do weekly with our with our clients, we call them. We don't call them defendants once they enter our programs. We call them clients. Mm-hmm. So that changes the perspective.
Okay.
That's what started changing. That's what interested me in becoming a judge, because then you're really involved into changing lives instead of just saying guilty or innocent or not guilty. Okay, here's your punishment if you're guilty. We don't want to ever see you again. Don't come back or it'll be worse. It's just changing the complete face and landscape of what we're doing in the criminal process system.
Right. Would you agree or disagree that most crimes, or a lot of crimes that you've dealt with as a prosecutor, has a lot to do with circumstances?
Absolutely. Both sides. I'll tell you, as a prosecutor and also as a defense attorney, definitely circumstances. That the root cause of people exhibiting we call it symptomatic behavior, which would be criminal behavior, and criminal behavior derives from overuse of drugs, alcohol, addictions, mental health issues. There's core issues that create that symptomatic behavior. Now, I will back off, because I'm definitely not a doctor, and say for mental health issues, a lot of people are just born, you know, with, you know, problems in their system, in their body, that, brain problems, or maybe hormonal problems, or, you know, whatever. The body is just a very complicated machine. And people are born that way, mental health issues. Those folks, obviously, they need help. And if they're doing things wrong, we can try to address that. But there's other people that create their own problems, unfortunately, because they're raised a certain way, not meaning a bad way, but, well, could be a situation in which is very harmful, very traumatic. We say most of our clients' behaviors are rooted in early traumatic harm that comes to them.
Mm-hmm.
And they're trying to deal with that harm, that trauma, past trauma, not by going to a mental health professional, because most people don't access that or have access, mm-hmm. but through alcohol and drug abuse. Mm-hmm. And so I would say, yes, that's a big problem. That's a root cause of most people. That commit crimes.
You know, as a prosecutor, do you feel that jail time all the time is the right answer for a lot of misdemeanor crimes?
So Pearl, I haven't been a prosecutor for a while, but when I was a prosecutor for a long time. So as a prosecutor, looking at it from a prosecutor's point of view, a lot of prosecutors are now understanding that, yes, A lot of those types of crimes, and that's what I saw. That's what really started getting me thinking about these specialty courts. A lot of these crimes are caused by situations that occur, and that's also by the use of alcohol, overuse, and abuse of alcohol and drugs, and by mental health issues. But yes, it's rooted in history. We all have had trauma in our lives, mm-hmm. all of us. And it's how we're dealing with it makes a difference. Some people are not equipped to deal with it well. Maybe they haven't had access to the appropriate help. And so they create situations in which they get themselves in trouble. I will tell you that.
Mm-hmm.
But then the idea is, okay, so what? We can blame. We can scold. But what can we really do to affect the change? And affect the change is that hand up to folks and telling them, there's another way. We could show you the path. But listen to us. Follow our model, follow our path, and we're here to support you and help you in this process. But you got to follow our rules.
Right.
Yes.
Okay. And so how do you see, you know, jail terms, rehabilitation, you know, in any individual?
So, again, let me go back and answer your question specifically. No, jail's not always the answer. And sometimes it can cause more harm than good. And we've gone down that road. The United States have gone down that road. We've punished. We've filled up the jails.
Mm-hmm.
We know that's not working. Mm-hmm. This is the other side of the pendulum swinging now and saying, you know, we've tried that experiment. People don't necessarily come out better mm-hmm. out of the prisons. They don't necessarily learn the lessons in the jails, because the habitual behavior still comes up. The trauma is still there. The problems are still there that exist. We need to treat that problem, the core problem. And so I see more harm than good in prisons. I will tell you this, though. There has to be accountability always. People have to be able to step up and say, listen, I did this wrong. I made a mistake, problems. And then you have to discern, but in that population, who's safe to work with, because you have to screen people, and who still would be problematic and unsafe. So you're always going to have to do that. There's going to be a certain section of society that are going to be harmful to others or to themselves. And there's just some things we can't do to help them right now at this point. We're not there yet, okay? Mm-hmm. There's science developing that I've heard about that could, mm-hmm. using, you know, interaction with brains, the mind, and stuff like that. But we're not quite there yet. But we are there with the data and the science that says if you can take certain individuals that are receptive, that are not too far gone, mm-hmm. and that are willing to go through programs, we have very, very good results with that section of the population. We do. And that's the majority. I would say that's a majority. And I'm saying majority, 60%, 60, 70%, maybe pushing 70%, where you can help most people get out of criminal behavior. If you start working on it hard, and if you make sure that you're working the model, and you have the right people in those programs.
Do you agree or disagree with three strike law?
Okay, so three strike law can come in many forms. There's three strike law can come perhaps with harmful behavior. Mm-hmm. I would veer. I've been on both sides. As a prosecutor, I was veer on the side of caution when people are still being harmful to others. Mm-hmm. That could be appropriate. That would be more appropriate to apply. Mm-hmm. When you're talking about three strikes for theft offenses, drugs, you know, behavior, stuff like that, those kind of crimes. What else? I'm thinking of the major ones. Theft is really big. Substance abuse, even DUIs, I would say no. Because you're talking with three strikes, and we should clarify what three strikes means. We know what it means. Yes. But we start in our own bubble, because I know you're pretty astute about what, you know, criminology and criminal justice is. Three strikes is when people are convicted of three types of crimes that are categorized. Any state can categorize what they want as a first strike, second strike, third strike. But after that third strike, it becomes minimum mandatories, and they're very penal, punitive type sentences. It could be, you know, 20 years minimum, right? No parole. Mm-hmm. Or it could be lifetime. Mm-hmm. So those kind of crimes where there's a mandatory, I don't necessarily agree for those types of crimes that I've stated are appropriate for three strikes. I think those few folks can be really rehabilitated, and that's been my whole idea, that folks that have the alcohol, drug abuse, substance abuse, mental health issues, government's working a little better with the mental health issues, but mostly substance abuse issues, those shouldn't be on the table for three strikes. Those should not be on the table. There should be intensive programs. I guess if people refuse to choose to go down the other path, mm-hmm. the path that's open to a better life, may be appropriate, but I would still veer on the side of not appropriate. It's just not, you know, for those kind of things, very appropriate, because you're not going to really be working with the individual at all or trying to change. You're warehousing at that point. And they're not harmful. Right. They're not harmful. That's the key. Can't be crimes of violence. Crimes of violence are different.
So would you agree or disagree that the justice system is working?
So we are in transition, I believe. I believe right now we're in a transitional period because we were being overly punitive before, mm-hmm. which resulted in mass incarceration, which resulted in nothing really being done but overly criminalizing people who commit crimes, mm-hmm. which I've said earlier, not all people who commit crimes are criminals. Mm-hmm. I want to differentiate between that concept, that they're criminals in the fact that they have committed crimes. And this may sound like lawyer speak, and it kind of is, but that they are not people that are going to potentially have to be criminals forever or the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. But they become criminalized because of the way the system handles them over a period of time. People that continually commit certain low-level crimes. You're building that history because you're not trying to help or treat them if they want the help. Mm-hmm. Okay, if they want the help. So you build a record, and even a small misdemeanor crimes, I call them small crimes, but they're still crimes, misdemeanor crimes as compared to felonies, mm-hmm. but you build a record, people start looking at that record. They start judging you on that record. You can't, it takes you out of society in a lot of ways. Jobs, benefits, societal benefits, ability to move beyond your level of where you're at. And that's what these small crimes can do to people. They can imprint on them to society that they're not worthy and not worthwhile, which is not necessarily true.
Okay. If you had extra dollars of a budget, how would you spend it and why?
I would spend as much possible money I can on mental health, helping people mental health. I get a large portion of my clients that have mental health issues. And again, I'd like to point out that I believe and what I've been trained and what I've learned over these years of practicing in therapeutic courts or specialty courts, is that people are abusing alcohol and drugs based upon their desire to try to treat themselves because they want to keep the harm that they've experienced, the trauma in their past life that they've experienced, at bay. They want to keep it away. They want to forget about it. And that's the wrong way to treat it. The right way to treat it is with extensive mental health, to have mental health available to everybody, to have decent health care available to everybody. And I also will say this, and it's controversial, housing. We need to have housing available for a lot of folks because they're not able to get themselves out of a situation because they're in bad places, they're in bad situations, and they can't get a foothold. So I think those three major things are huge, and I think they could really move the ball if we could apply a lot more of our resources towards those areas. I could go off education. There's more, you know, there's a stack of it. But those three main areas to start, because they deal with the key areas of population that are most affected by criminal behavior, mm-hmm. and being around criminal behavior. So I think that would make a huge difference to start. But it would just be a start. There's a lot more, as we know.
Right. Well, what is your views about Nevada ranking high record numbers for youth homelessness, suicide, and youth sex trafficking?
So I'm on the Washoe County Behavioral Health Advisory Board, and I've been on that for almost 4 years now. And I will tell you, I got on it because I was interested in, you know, learning more about behavioral health and the health, behavioral health care in our area, Washoe County. And I was fortunate enough to get appointed, and it's been an education. The numbers, the stats, we are, you know, our boat has so many holes in it right now. We are in a bad place. We are trying. We have a lot of earnest people that are really working hard over time trying to do it. But without the adequate resources available, meaning let's get down to it, money and training and training the right people to help us, that's not going to happen. There's not going to be any changes. And it's very disappointing to see our youth suicide rate. I was shocked to see how bad it was. I don't know the stat. Maybe you know it, but when I first heard it about a year or two ago, because they did an extensive review of that, mm-hmm. we were right on top.
Yeah.
That's the wrong number to be on top.
Yeah.
And that is sad. And that shows you where we need to be focusing a lot of our resources. Mm-hmm. And that's where I would focus a lot of my mental health resources with the youth, to have a place. I mean, because they've given up, mm-hmm. at a point when you're not supposed to even, you're not even thinking, you know, the road's ahead of you. You got your life and the road ahead of you. And these folks, these young folks have given up already, and the stress they're going through, and they've decided to give up that early. That's just an astounding, mind-boggling concept to me.
What would you like the people to know about Henry Sotelo?
I will tell you that I work very hard every day in the work I do. I will tell you that I'm going to be, as a judge, to show up every day, not just sitting there on the bench, mm-hmm. and judging, but also getting out in the community, mm-hmm. and reaching out with as much power and influence and advocacy as I can do. Oh, that must be someone that really wants to talk to us. Yes, girl, that's exciting. Yes. I know. The phone's been buzzing.
The phones are buzzing. Yeah. We're getting a lot of calls right now.
So that I would tell people that I'm not going to just be a judge sitting behind the bench. I'm going to be a judge in the community. This has been my community. I embraced this community 40 years ago. This has been where I raised my children. This is where I love to be. And this is considered my home. And I will work every day very hard to move some of these. I want to stay on as many boards as I'm allowed ethically to stay on. And that would include the mental health board, because I really feel the need that we need to change and move the ball on that. And I will tell everybody, I'm only running for one term, because one term, I'm not going to buy into the reelection process that I have to appease people. Not to mean that, of course, I'm going to be accountable for my actions, but I will move the ball as far as I can and as hard as I can, and not worry about stepping on toes and breaking eggs, because it's important that we do that. We need to have forward thinkers, progressive thinkers about this. And I see a lot of cadre of judges that have been running during this campaign are the same ideas, that we need to do something more than just sit behind the bench. We need to be community leaders, because we all know, you know, and I have respect, the old idea, the old concept, there are some courts that where it's appropriate. Judges, you know, they do their job and they're behind the bench and they do a good job, but I'm not going to be that kind of judge. And I'm going to make sure, as long as it's ethical, for me to be pushing in the community, outreaching, and I'll be available to talk to any groups, any people that want to talk to me and reach out to me with ideas. Because again, I'm not a know-it-all. I've learned over even my old age, like I said, when I joined that Washoe County Behavioral Health Board, how much I learned just within last decade of my life so far about these therapeutic courts and what we can do with them to change the trajectory of people's lives and help everybody. I always look at it as a ripple effect: individual, family, community. It grows out like that, and that's what we need to focus on. And I promise to do that every day that I work that I'm a judge for 6 years, and I'm not quitting early unless I, you know, drop dead. I couldn't help that part, but I'm not quitting early. I'm not going to go for that either. This is not a retirement job. I'm going to work hard the whole time.
I'm so very proud of you.
Oh, my God. Thank you so much. That's so sweet of you.
So what do you consider to be your greatest strength and your weakness?
So greatest strength is I have courage. I mean, I don't want to, I'm getting used to talking about myself more and more, but I have courage. I have the courage to face, power. Those that are in power, those that have power over me. I'm not afraid to speak out and to be a fervent advocate for what I think is right. Mm-hmm. My greatest weakness is I don't want people to get in my way. I mean, that's the other side of the coin, correct? Mm-hmm. When you jump into the fray, you got to have the courage to fight. And when you're in a fight, you got to fight hard. And there's, you know, sometimes I got to learn, you know, to back off, to listen to whatever other folks have to say and do. But I've learned that over time. I've been put on my butt a few times because of that. I'm not saying I'm always in the right. I could be thinking I'm in the right and being courageous about it, but I could have some information wrong. So I'm learning to be open. I'm learning to be patient and to listen better and to be open to other ideas. And so I think I'm ready for that. I'm ready for that. I'd also like to tell you, being 20 years as an educator at the community college, full-time as a law professor for the paralegal program, and the coordinator, the director of that program, has taught me a lot of that skill, because I have to listen to students. You know, students have questions. They can question me. That's their job, is to question me. I don't know it all, but I get to show them what I know and show them a path. So I've learned a lot because of that. But I'd say, you know, sitting down, listening, and be able to let the adrenaline drop down a little bit, and the fight in me, you know, simmer so I can listen to other people and listen to their ideas. So that's why I tell you, I'll be out there in the community, because that's part of it. I put myself out there. Be campaigning, doing this campaign for this job, the judicial position, has taught me a lot about that too. Because when you're humbled, you go to doors, you talk to voters, you're asking for their vote. You can't just say, well, you know, you just got to trust me. Mm-hmm. But I know what I'm doing. Mm-hmm. You know, people have opinions.
So do you have any ties to the community?
So I've been on many, is that what you mean? Many boards, stuff like that. Yes. I've been, again, one of my pride and joy, Washoe County Behavioral Health Advisory Board for 4 years. I was appointed to the initial, as an inaugural member of the Reno Human Rights Commission. That was great. I did that for 2 years, working with city council, the Nevada Latino Bar Association. So I'm trying to involve myself with lots of different aspects of our community. Northern Nevada Literacy Council, which also got funding, scholarships, encouragement to people to get their GEDs and their diplomas to get them out in the workforce. That went along really well with my being an educator at TMCC. I work on the Nevada Faculty Alliance Legal Defense Committee, and that means I'm on the NFA union, and that's not Nevada Faculty Alliance. As a faculty member at TMCC, we're part of the whole Nevada Faculty Alliance, and I've been on their committee as the legal advisor on that board for many years. And I've also worked as the pro bono coordinator for the Domestic Violence Resource Center. And this is interesting because as a defense attorney, guess what kind of cases I get? Mm-hmm. Domestic violence cases, and those are my clients.
Mm-hmm.
And so I want to keep the balance. And so I give pro bono advice to the victims of domestic violence, and that's what the DVRC does. Mm-hmm. They help domestic violence victims get out of their situation, help them relocate, help them transition from that life because it's a mindset they hit. They feel like a prisoner where they're at. And so part of my job was to give them legal advice on, you know, family law and, you know, next steps, things like that. I give them also advice on criminal behavior, criminal law, too, so that they understand how the criminal process worked. But I did that for a good 2 years before COVID, and then COVID pretty much shut it down. So that was keeping my balance with my defense counsel aspect of my life. Mm-hmm. I try to do that. So I have a lot of outreach in the community, of course, being an educator for 20 years and a lawyer for 20 years. A lot of outreach in the community for different aspects. I'm always giving advice to people, pro bono advice. I feel that that's part of my duty as an officer of the law and the court.
Have you ever dealt with any civil rights or anti-discrimination actions?
So I don't practice in civil rights area. That is a very, very, what I would say it's a complicated area, but also you have to be able to devote a lot of time to it. And but I know a lot of lawyers locally that do, and I always advise if I get those kind of cases and involvement, I always refer those folks to the best lawyers that I know, the lawyers I would hire if I needed help like that. I do a lot of that, but I've talked to so many groups, the Washoe Democratic Black Caucus. You know, I've talked to so many different types of groups in this community about their rights. I know generally how to advise people about their rights and civil rights. I've educated many students on civil rights as an educator, but I don't practice in that area. Like I said, you got to be devoted. And we have a handful of really devoted attorneys that will do that work much better than I ever could.
Right. Are you interested in any environmental issues in the community?
Well, yes, of course I'm not involved in the environmental advocacy as much as a lot of folks are, but very much, you know, I'm a proponent of, you know, environmental issues and making sure that we are keeping our community healthy with the way we use our resources, the way, you know, we are utilizing our land space, the way we are allocating our open space here in our community. But yes, I'm always a supporter, not advocate. I don't want to misname that, a supporter of those concepts also.
Okay. And so for those of you that are just tuning in, I'm Pearl J. We have Henry Sotelo here. And Mr. Sotelo, can you just share with the audience, you know, a brief background of what you do right now in the state of Nevada?
Sure. What I'm doing right now is I have a private practice, my own law private practice, and it's dealing mostly in the area of criminal law. But I also am, the biggest part of my practice is a contract attorney considered to be the public defender of the city of Reno courts in the Reno Municipal Court. So that's my biggest part of my practice, but I do take private clients also. But if I can't help them or I'm too busy, I'm concerned about people that need help, I always refer to the best lawyers that I would know and advise to be referred to. So I'm very involved in the community in that aspect. That's my law practice. Again, I'm also an educator, going on a little over 20 years now at Truckee Meadows Community College, working in and directing as a full-time law professor in the paralegal program.
All right. So what do you see as rewards of working in the area of law?
So, well, one of the biggest rewards is that you get to really affect outcomes for people that are in trouble, that need help and that are in trouble. That is the biggest reward, to seeing that it feels good to be able to help people at their very biggest time in need when they're involved in the law and see themselves in trouble. Again, dealing with the therapeutic and specialty courts, there's even a bigger reward for me, that to see over time how you can really, you know, the old adage is that, you know, you can't teach an old dog any new tricks, and that's not true. You know, after a certain age, we all become an old dog. Even late 20s becomes an old dog because your mind has been set. Your brain's not growing anymore. So that old theory is not true. I've seen it happen over and over. I've had clients that were in their late 60s and 70s that were alcoholics their whole life. Multiple DUIs and drinking issues, losing everything, family, friends. And they've come into our program. They got a DUI. And it's a misdemeanor DUI, obviously, since they haven't had any in a while, but they still have that history. And they come and they want to change their life, even though they've got, you know, maybe a couple decades left or a decade or whatever. And I've seen the change. I've seen them change their life. And what I always hear is, wish I would have done this before. Wish it would have been available before. And so I'm always pleased to hear that. And I've seen that the adage is not true. You can change people. You can help people change themselves because they have to want to do that. You can help people with that. And that's very rewarding.
Do you have any children that's following your footsteps?
This is a funny joke because my daughter was thinking about it when she was going to college. And I says, don't do it. I was looking at a perspective is that there's so much in life you could do. Mm-hmm. There's so much in life. And of course, you think about lawyers and doctors. But there was so much. It was kind of a joke, but not kind of a joke. I told her, I said, but if you want to do it, I mean, I'd be glad for you to do it. You know, it's been a good gig, you know, to joke about it. It's been a good life for me. It's provided a good life for myself and my family. And I've been able to change different areas of it and evolve over time into the lawyer that I am now and helping people in different ways. So I would say, short answer is no. No, they're not going to be able to follow dad. My daughter went and became a speech and language pathologist, though, which is very helpful to the community, working with children and folks that need to learn speech skills for whatever reason. And my son, who's 16, his name is Enrique Sotelo, he has Down syndrome. So Enrique won't be becoming a lawyer, but he's developing in his own way. And we're very proud of him and how hard he works. He probably works way harder than I ever worked in my whole life to be where he's at now. Mm-hmm. You know, he's a student at Miss McQueen right now. They've got a great program at McQueen and they love him there. They treat him with respect and dignity, and he's bloomed there. So my daughter's doing very well. She's living in Germany and teaching teaching the students speech and language pathology of the military that are stationed in Germany. So she's enjoying her life there right now, for now. She's a U.S. citizen. And so we'll see what happens and develops in the future, but no children in the law. No children in the law, just daddy-o.
Okay. So have you ever had any cases that you dealt with where it caused you to have like severe anxiety or depression, you know, because of the type of case you were handling?
Yes. I could just say capital letters. Yes, I've had cases like that. I will tell you, there's not one in particular that stands out. But this is interesting. You're asking a question that I was asked recently, too, about any one case that stands out. Like, more than anything, it's not one case. It's the whole spectrum of the cases that I deal with people in trouble and really how they are at their worst place in their life and how they got there, and they all have stories. And it's a very sad, it's usually when people are talking to me and they've had a period of time where they've been committing crimes, they're in very, very bad places in their head, in their life. They have no resources. That's what really gets to me. So it's not the a particular case, but the spectrum and the length and the amount of cases I've had that have the very same similar like, you know, facts almost or history. Everybody's an individual, but those histories are so similar. That's what brought me to the idea again. And I know I keep repeating myself of the therapeutic and specialty courts, because you just see the similarities, and it's like it's not just something happened chance that happens to certain people. It happens to a broad spectrum of people over our population, that they're in such a bad place for various reasons that are very similar that we can address.
Has there ever been any situations where you actually, because of your job, had to fear for your life?
There may have been times where I have been, as a prosecutor mostly, where I was worried. I remember, that's good. Now that's bringing up something. Yeah, this is like a therapy session here. I remember as a prosecutor, when I became a prosecutor, of course I want to be the best person I can be. And I don't want to get in trouble or be in a situation. But I remember I became very paranoid about being around crowds, going to places where you would get crowds, like as go to, you know, restaurants where there's big crowds, or concerts, or those kind of social activities. I completely cut them out of my life during my prosecution days, because you see the random stuff that can happen in these places and you become very paranoid. So I wouldn't say there was a specific case where I was in fear that someone was going to come at me personally because I was prosecuting their case. Not to say that doesn't happen. I've known prosecutors and I've talked to prosecutors where that's happened, where there's been a direct threat. But to me, it became a slow change of lifestyle because of the trouble you see that occurs in society and the community. And you could just be around and be randomly involved by it. And I became paranoid about that. So it did change my character in a lot of ways for a long time. Less so now, but that still exists. Because, of course, I'm on the other side of it, and I still see the trouble that people could get themselves into. And, you know, life's random sometimes, and you start thinking about that.
Yeah. Has it ever been, like, any situations where you just was like, you know, I don't even want to deal with this. You know, this is just too bad, you know.
So there are cases where I will withdraw from, or as a prosecutor, not necessarily. I never had that choice or never had a situation where I don't necessarily want to be involved in the case, but I can remember as defense attorney, and I think this occurs more because on the defense side, there are people you don't want to be involved with because you could see that there's red flags that occur. And that occurs as an older attorney. I could see mm-hmm. certain red flags, whereas a younger attorney, I couldn't see them. And I'd run into these situations and I'm like, oh my God, you know, this is a tough situation. But as an older attorney, I could see the red flags, and I will withdraw from a case if I feel there is. Because there's a couple of things, not just for myself, because of my personal feelings about the situation, but also you have to be of the mindset that you can properly advocate and defend this person. And if I feel that there's a problem between me and this person, there's a dynamic that is unhealthy, mm-hmm. then of course I can't. Mm-hmm. As an advocate, that's you know, I'm sworn to do this. I need to do it the right way.
Right.
And so I will do that for myself. Of course, there's a selfish motive, but at the same time, I'm compromising my ability to properly advocate and defend this person.
From the stress, because I know I know the cases have to be very, very stressful at times. Has that affected your marriage, your home life?
Absolutely. Yes, it has. Mm-hmm. And I've learned to deal with it. My wonderful wife has learned to deal with it, and we deal with it. But it has provided, you know, distance at times, more times than not, but it still does. At times, it still comes up. It still comes up, Pearl, that kind of thing.
How do you bring balance in between your, you know, your job, your marriage, you know, and all of that?
It's a constant work in progress, and it's always moving. Mm-hmm. It's never, you know, there was a period of time when I remember I could do it more than other times, mm-hmm. but it's a constant moving target, and you always have to be aware of it, because if you think you've got it handled, you may not. I'm lucky my spouse is a licensed clinical social worker. That helps because she knows where to set the boundaries, and she knows to tell me, you know, you need to be thinking about what you're doing right now. You need to be aware and stuff like that. That helps a lot. But still, even so, with someone like that on your side, still, it's still difficult. You know, I fight against it because I'm so involved. The campaign has also been overwhelming, too. You know, it's part of it. You know, I'm so involved and so focused. And again, being the person I am that wants to really achieve an ambition, I become very, the blinders, like I said, the blinders, the best way I could describe it. I have blinders on because I'm so looking down this path and I don't want anything to interrupt that or stop that. But that's the same way I deal with my work, too, and my work as a professor, too. But it's a constant moving target, like I said, and it's a project that I always have to work on. And so it's never going to be perfect, but if you're aware of it, then that's the first step in dealing with it, correct?
Amen.
Yes, yes.
All right. And so let me ask you, what's next? I mean, you know, I know you're running, you know, this campaign for Judge and all this. But, you know, what's next for Henry Sotelo?
Well, right before me, put the blinders on a little bit. I'm gonna get on the bench, and I'm gonna really work hard to do what I can. The court I will be getting on as a judge deals with the community court. That's a big project. The community court deals with the unsheltered folks in our community. That's when I'm knocking on the doors, when I'm talking to our local folks, that's one of the biggest issues they bring up. What are you going to do about the homeless? They call them homeless. And, you know, that's a term I don't find offensive, but a lot of folks want to use unsheltered, which I'm fine with, too. And I say, well, you know, I'm going to bring the community into this to help me, and I'm going to try to bring private interest. I'm going to try to do things and change this, and it's going to be a very, very overwhelming project. It's going to be a challenge, and I'm not going to say I have all the answers, and I'm not saying I'm going to cure it, but I'm going to chip away at it, and we're going to start moving the ball the way it should be moved. We're going to start looking at this and working on it. And so that's my near future. Again, it's hard to think about, you know, beyond what I'm going to be trying to do on the bench. But after 6 years, I think I'll be ready to step back a little bit, but I'll be involved in the community still. I'll be more of a person involved in the community, and it'll be volunteering. I don't think I could ever step out of that role anymore. I never was involved. I'll be honest with you, before we'll say a decade, 12 years ago, 15 years ago, maybe, my idea, it was like I was doing my job. I was doing a good job. I'm doing enough for the community. I didn't volunteer for anything. I mean, maybe, you know, my kids, you know, going to softball or something like that, but nothing ever larger than myself. But once I became a believer in doing something more with the criminal justice system, within the criminal justice system, I started volunteering because, okay, this is good. It'll make me get educated, and it's the right thing to do. And I understood why people do this more for the community, volunteering, pushing out there, advocating for certain community goals without being paid, without trying to get anything from it except that you're trying to do something more than who you are and bigger than yourself. So I drank the Kool-Aid. I'm involved with that, and that's why I want to stay that way as a judge too. But even after getting off the bench one term, remember that, 6 years, one term, I'm going to still stay involved in the community. As long as I can stay and keep healthy and a good balance with it, I'll still do that too, in whatever ways I can.
What do you see, you know, I mean, maybe I should say it like this. How do you see the difference in between where you are now in law and crossing that line, you know, to become a judge on, that's basically like you're on the other side, you know.
You're in the middle, which is the worst place to be in a fight,
right,
isn't it?
Yeah, you know, so how do you see, you know, the responsibilities that come with that?
Good question. So I will tell you, over the years, for about 5 years, while I was in private practice, but not appointed to this particular court as the court-appointed attorney on contract, I did a lot of substitute judging, which is called judge pro tem judge. So I was sworn in Reno Municipal Court as the substitute judge when judges took breaks or, you know, vacations, or they were sick, or they needed to do something else in the community. I was called in to do those dockets, dozens and dozens of dockets, and hundreds of cases I've sat as a judge. So it is the first time I did it. It was scary and it was different, mm-hmm. and you have to be very aware. Mm-hmm. But over time, I became used to the idea and used to the concept of sitting in the middle, not being an advocate but listening, mm-hmm. Judging by facts and law and arguments, what I should do. And it's a hard skill. It's a tough skill to stay in the middle and not try to use a bias or your own ideas on what you should do, but looking at everything as a neutral party and then making the best decision you can based upon the knowledge that you've learned, the facts and the law. So I'm comfortable with it. That's why I feel that I could do a good job as a judge. The nuts and bolts is being on that bench making those decisions. The other part would be real fun to do, the advocacy part in the community, talking about what we're doing. But you still have to be able to do that, and I'm very comfortable with that concept now.
Okay. And how do you see yourself uniquely different from any other judge?
So I will tell you, there's a lot of judges that I very much look up to because they've done incredible jobs and incredible work. I can't necessarily compare myself to all the others, but I can compare myself in this position, for this position, that between me and my opponent, I have vastly more experience. I have more experience in all of the roles because I've practiced all of the roles. The prosecution for many years at a felony level, understanding those crimes, at the misdemeanor level, a decade of that experience. As the judge pro tem for 5 years, and also as a contract attorney, the court-appointed attorney for municipal court, going over 10 years now, I've done all of those roles, and I'm very experienced in those roles. And I also bring to the table as an educator, being able to, you know, talk to people, understand people, be able to figure them out and what is best for them at that moment in their life, the most vulnerable moment of their life. How can I help them? Being an educator has helped me with that. And then I think my life of experience. I mean, I've had downs. I've had down times. I've had problems, personal problems in my life that I've had to deal with, and I still bounced back. I still came back. So I know that I can also relate to people that are in those down times, bad times, and not thinking that there's a way out of that situation and be able to offer that advice and that understanding, that empathy. Mm-hmm. I've been there. I've lived a long life. I'm 61 years old, and that comes with some quality and understanding of human nature and in the areas I've dealt with. You know, you're hands-on you're hands-on as a lawyer and you're hands-on as an educator. And so I think I have those qualities to offer in this position as it is now, and my vast amount of experience as a specialty court attorney in three of the four specialty courts in Reno Municipal Court. The Veterans Court, which I helped create from ground up with Judge Shelley O'Neill. The Fresh Start Court, which was an informal DUI court when we first started, but I was brought on and I helped bring that up into a different modernization of that court, and it's been great. And then the community court, when it was created, I was one of the initial attorneys brought in to help form that and help create it and help get it to where it's at now, which would be the court I would be inheriting. I'd be proud and honored to be able to inherit that court and take it further into the future. All of these I bring to the table to this position, and I will use all of them to the best of my abilities, and I think that's what separates me from my opponent. Every other judge out there, we're all in our boats. We're rowing our own boats, aren't we? And I think all of the judges, we all kind of would share the same concept of where we've been and bringing our personal lives to the bench and utilize them to the best of our abilities. It's hard to compare with every other judges because they're all in different positions, so that'd be tough. But I do know in my small boat, in the lake I'm rowing in right now, the lake of Reno Municipal Court and Department 4, I'm best suited for that position.
Okay. Well, I want to ask you, what would you say to a young entrepreneur trying to follow your footsteps?
That's a great idea to have. Be an entrepreneur for yourself. You are your own business. I like that concept. And I've thought of that at times too, because I never thought of myself as an entrepreneur. You always use that in form of a business concept, but the idea of entrepreneurial has to do with your mindset and how you treat yourself and how you get yourself in the best position you can for your own career, whatever that career would be. And I would say embrace the entrepreneurial spirit. Entrepreneurial means always learning, always looking for challenges, always not shying away from challenges, always being courageous, and always thinking about what's around the corner, about plan A, plan B, plan C. That's been the savior. And I was joking with my wife today because she used to give me a hard time when we were first dating. You always have different plans. And I go, that's the way I've always thought. You always have to have that plan A, plan B, plan C. It doesn't mean one's worse than the next. It just means one's different from the next and you have different ways you could go. So when you meet these challenges, you're able to organize your thoughts. You're able to adapt to the situations that arise. And looking in hindsight of my life, you're going to have a lot of different paths, young folks. No matter what you think, no matter what your ideas are, you're going to have a lot of different paths in your life and changes and crossroads and detours you're going to have to make, and you have to be ready for those. So train yourself to be ready for those. Embrace those challenges. I'd like to have a fewer right now because I'm older. It's hard, but I know that's going to happen. But you young folks, be prepared for it and embrace it because it is exciting. It's not a negative thing. It's a positive thing.
Looking back on all your years in law enforcement, do you have any regrets?
Let's see. Regrets. That Frank Sinatra song comes up. Regrets, I've had a few, but none that really bother me. Because I'll tell you, mistakes that were made today, I'm a result of those mistakes that were made, and I've learned from those mistakes. And so to say regrets, maybe I should have traveled more when I was younger. Maybe I shouldn't have been so serious when I was younger, worried about this and that, worried about what's going to come, maybe dealing with more in the present, bigger concepts like that versus, you know, decisions I made, mm-hmm. you know, decisions I made in particular. More of like, I should have embraced life more in a bigger manner as a younger person and not, oh, this is a good one. Don't be afraid. Don't be afraid. You know, be courageous. Don't be afraid of things. Don't be afraid to try a challenge. You know, write down your most fearful things that you could possibly do, your most challenging things, and look at that list and keep looking at that list and get used to that list and then start, you know, marking off that list a little by little. And you chip away at that list and you're going to realize there is nothing to be afraid of. There is nothing to be afraid of. And so that's what I would say. I was very afraid. I was very scared to do anything that was too big, thinking that could never possibly happen. I think that's a big regret of mine. But I've tried to overcome that as I got older.
In law, if there was one thing that you could change, what would it be?
One thing. Parole and her absolutes. I'm a lawyer. I'm trained for the gray areas. I'm trained to be like moving within that gray area. The absolutes, it just don't work. That just doesn't work. But with the human condition. But one thing I would change is, okay, you know what I would say is not necessarily in the law. What I would change is I'm going to draw back. I would change in the way people are educated in the law. Not lawyers, but students, young people that are educated, how they're educated. Everybody should take, I should be able to help write a law 101 class, and it should be taught in elementary school at a certain level, and then retaught at that junior high with a little bit more information, and then retaught at high school, and then college. Law 101, meaning this is how law works. This is how the Constitution is. These are your rights, you know, as a citizen of this country, and your rights if there is, in fact, some problems with the criminal process. Those are empowering areas. That would really change the law. That would change a lot of this country, I think, if people really understood it and didn't think it was their problem to learn a lot of this stuff, or it's too much because you introduce them early and it doesn't become a black box. And that's what the law is for a lot of people. Still, I get most people are, well, the law is so hard. It's not hard. Trust me, if I learned it, it's not hard. It just takes a lot of hard work. You know, it's hard, not hard to learn. It just takes work. But that can be broken down. People can learn. So the way I would change the law, I would go before even people are involved in the law or the process of law. Because if you change the culture, if you change the way people think about the law, then the law will change. And I think it would be more humane in its process of people, and it's the way it deals with people. So I guess I just answered my question. Humanity, more humanity in the law. We're getting there, Pearl.
Okay.
We're not quite close enough, but we're getting there.
So for your campaign followers, what message would you like to leave for them today?
Okay, first thing, again, soteloforjudge.com. We're voting now. Everybody's voting now. I want them to leave. I want to get that information out there. Look me up on my website and see what I've done over my long period of life. And I want them to also understand.
Excuse me.
I will be, thank you, Pearl. I will be open. I will be transparent. I want to open the courts up to the citizens, because that's their court. I get to sit in that court. I get to be in that court as a, and I know it's a word that's overused a lot, as a public servant, but I really believe in that concept. Okay, you don't get to tell me what you want to do all the time. There's a position to be made, but what you get to do is you get to be in there, you get to watch, you get to know what we're doing, and you get to advise, you know, court in certain ways, what we can do better. How can we treat people better? How can we be the best court we can possibly be? I will be very open to that. That over my period of time, I've seen how courts can operate, and we can go there and be more interactive with citizens. And I think, in Reno Municipal Court, we're definitely more interactive with the population now.
All right. Well, you heard it right here on Faces of Success Radio and TV. I'm your host, Pearl J. Please look up Henry Sotelo for me, please, and put your votes in. I want to thank you for being a guest on Faces of Success Radio and coming in personally to the studio today. And once again, can you leave your website information for our listeners?
One more time. Soteloforjudge.com, and that's spelled Sotelo forjudge.com. Thank you very much, Pearl. It's been an honor. It's going to be it's a momentous time in my life, period of my life. I'm always going to remember this interview. You asked some really good questions.
Thank you.
And they're important questions always to ask. Thank you so much.
Thank you. All right.